Leah Nafok. Welcome to Milwaukee.
Hi, everybody.
And wow, what a crowd.
Incredible. Thanks so much for being here.
It's kind of surreal that how many years, what, 44 years after Watergate, we have this many people in a room to discuss it?
Totally. It's great to see everybody here.
So I'm wondering, as the reporter on this series, whether you came out of it with the same feeling that I did as a listener, the somewhat odd feeling that I wish the crisis had gone on longer.
I was saying this to Mitch before we started. We did 8 episodes, and towards the end, I felt like we were rushing through a lot of good stuff, and I almost wish that we could have done 12 or something, so that we could have slowed down a little bit and chewed on it a little bit longer, because it did feel like we were sort of tumbling down a hill as the impeachment inquiry heated up, and we could have spent a little more time on it, I think.
It's like that phenomenon in history class where you spend all this time in the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then like the last two classes you do the entire 20th century.
That's right. Well, when I started working on this, I rewatched all the President's Men just to like remind myself of what it was I already vaguely knew about Watergate and what other people might be expected to know. And I was astonished to realize that the actual film covers the first like 5.5-6 months of the story, and then the entire, you know, I think like another year and a half gets montaged through a bunch of newspaper headlines in the way that you just described.
Right. So how well versed did you think you were on Watergate when you went into this process?
I did not think I was well versed, but it didn't occur to me that there were as many sort of intriguing subplots and as many characters that I wasn't even remotely aware of, as it turned out, there are. I kind of was skeptical initially when my editors wanted to undertake this project, because I felt like this is a pretty familiar story. People know there was a break-in at the DNC. People know that it was controversial, and people know that he was forced out of office because of it. How much more to it? How much more could there be to it? And so it was when I read the story of Martha Mitchell that my eyes were opened to all the really delightful details and sort of peripheral characters that I learned about over the course of my research.
So the Martha Mitchell story was the first story you uncovered?
Yeah, I mean, uncovered, you know, it's a funny word. I mean, no, I felt like I had uncovered it, but like, it's in all the books, you know, it's...
Unearthed, maybe.
Yeah.
It's
funny, because when I talk to people who are a little bit older or who have read all those Watergate books, they're like, you didn't know who Martha Mitchell was? Like, my boss, Slate's chairman, Jacob Weisberg, had me on his show. He has a show called Trumpcast, and he had me on Trumpcast when Slow Burn started. And he really chewed me out on the air for not knowing who Martha Mitchell was. And I had to not admit that I barely knew who John Mitchell was.
Well, you just brought up an interesting point a minute ago. You went back and watched All the President's Men, and you make the point in the series a couple of times that not only is it the Woodward and Bernstein version of Watergate that really dominates the public consciousness 45 years later, but it's really the movie version of the Woodward and Bernstein story. What did you learn in doing this series about how some accounts get to be history of record while others get to be forgotten, more or less?
Yeah, it's a totally fascinating question. We did a live show in New York about 2 weeks ago, and that was actually the exact theme of the night, was how do certain narratives become so sticky that they get passed on, and others sort of fall away? You know, why? Like, what is the logic behind why some things become conventional wisdom, or why some things become sort of part of our collective consciousness and others don't? I don't really have a great answer. I think with All the President's Men, I mean, I think it probably helps that it was a great film. It helps that Robert Redford was in it. Bob Woodward was one of the guests at our event, and I asked him. I wanted him to sort of talk about what it was like to or what it's like, what it's been like to be sort of Mr. Watergate, to be responsible for like the dominant version of the story, when you know a lot of the chapters of the story have nothing to do with journalism. You know, there's a chapter about the Senate, there's a chapter about the House, there's a chapter about the Special Prosecutor's Office. All of these different kind of institutions had to function in order for the story to go the way it did. And for the most part, those aren't really in the Woodward and Bernstein version because, you know, why should it be? I mean, they were telling their story, right? Their book is about their reporting process. But it's not just a story about journalism. And so I believe the best thing, I think the best thing he said was, well, what has it been like? I've disappointed a lot of women, meaning doesn't look quite like Robert Redford, which took me a second on stage. It took me a second too long before I could laugh.
A few seconds ago, changed a verb tense from are to were when you were talking about the characters. But there is something significant to this story in that not all, but many of the people in the orbit of Watergate are still alive and are still, I don't know, happy to talk about that period?
Yeah, well, so you said still. I don't know if still is the right word or if it's the opposite, where they're like, eh, I'm like 85. I might as well talk about this now. We had people that we interviewed who were really, really eager to sort of relive this part of their lives because it was an extremely important part of who they became. And a lot of these people were amazingly like in their 20s and 30s when they were, you know, working for the Senate investigative committee, when they were working for the House when the impeachment probe was underway. The whole like staff of the Special Prosecutor's Office were these kids in their late 20s, early 30s, fresh out of law school, who were hanging out together drinking when they weren't, you know, collecting evidence on Nixon's obstruction of justice.
You can almost imagine it being an Aaron Sorkin series.
You could imagine that. I wish someone more important than me could imagine it. but like Aaron Sorkin, perhaps.
He's not here, is he?
But yeah, like there was one of the people we interviewed, Curtis Prinz. He appears in episode 2. He worked for Wright Patman, who was the congressman who tried to investigate Watergate a few months before the 1972 election. He like knew there was something. He could smell a rat, and he knew that Nixon's fingerprints were on it, and he wanted to investigate it, but he was basically outvoted by his fellow committee members on the question of whether to take on subpoena power or not, and so the investigation was kind of scuttled. But Curtis Prinz, who worked for Patman, when I called him, he said, "I've been waiting for someone to call me for you know God knows how long." I was the first person to investigate Watergate. I'm sure that's true depending on how you define it. But it was a real thrill to be able to hear his account in the first person for the first time.
What were to you the biggest challenges in trying to tell this story in that sort of real time fashion 4 decades after it happened?
So the hardest part I think was sort of finding the right individuals to tell each part of the story, right? So we, our first move in kind of after we'd sort of done our preliminary research was to try to outline this story and try to divide it into chunks. We knew we wanted to do 8 episodes. I'm not really sure how we decided on 8, but we knew 8 was the number. And so, the first challenge was to try to figure out where each one would start and where they would end. And then sort of try to find, sort of conceptual questions that each one could be focused on. So like episode 3 was about why it took so long for the American people to start caring about Watergate and to become interested in it and become concerned that the president had done all these things. Nixon won by a massive landslide in 1972, despite the fact that, all those stories that we see being reported out in All the President's Men were already published. And even though Walter Cronkite had put on an unprecedented special on the news about all the connections between these burglars and the White House, and so it was sort of triangulating between like, we got to get from here to here in the timeline, and we got to find the right characters who will allow us to tell that part of the story and like allow us to explore these sort of thematic questions that we wanted each episode to be about. Sort of, does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, and the thing that really strikes me is that the number of, you know, kind of authors and historians that assist you in telling the story is pretty low. This is not a Ken Burns series.
Yeah, I think we tried to keep it pretty light on secondary sources. I think we have like probably between 1, 2, and 3 in each episode. You know, the best use of, I think, secondary sources was in this series was when you had someone who was an expert on something very narrow. Like we had a historian who just knows everything about Wright Patman. She wrote a book about Wright Patman, and so it was just great to be able to have her sort of ransack her research, you know, for us, and then tell us everything she knows about it. You know, but we also interviewed someone, you know, people like Rick Perlstein, who has written extensively and broadly about Nixon and the conservative movement in general. And so I think we always wanted to use people who were there when we could, and then use historians to sort of give us the scaffolding of sort of like what is the significance of it, not so much narrate the stories, which we wanted to leave to the individuals who lived through them.
I don't think I mentioned this before, but there will be a chance, a pretty good chance, for people to ask questions of your own. So be thinking of those, and we'll get to them as we can in a few minutes. You bring up Wright Patman. You also make a really interesting comparison in the first episode of the show about Martha Mitchell. You compare her to Anthony Scaramucci, mm-hmm. Who was White House Communications Director for like 25 minutes last summer.
That's right.
But the point you make is that for every huge story, there are these people who are briefly important players, Wright Patman, Martha Mitchell, any number of people in the series, who are largely forgotten, except in maybe really difficult trivia competitions.
Right.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, otherwise we get the, you know, to be able to tell any history, we're hit with the information fire hose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a necessary process, sort of. I'm reaching for the metaphor. What's the thing that you use to sifting? There you go. Thank you. You know, I think in 45 years, like who are going to, and I've wondered this, like who will be the characters in the drama that's currently unfolding that will be remembered? You know, it's funny you mentioned, so Anthony Scaramucci was my comparison point for Martha Mitchell, not because they were both, you know, got in trouble for talking to reporters, though it turned out they have that in common as well. But because they do both seem like sort of peripheral in the same way. But then more recently, a guy whose name I had to work very hard 10 seconds ago to remember, Sam Nunberg, who was like a friend of Trump's, possibly a lawyer of Trump's, I don't even remember, went on television, drunk, and said all kinds of things he wasn't supposed to say. And suddenly he was the Martha Mitchell of the current crisis, and I'll be really interested to see who are the sort of lasting figures, because I think this is the story that we're seeing now is like just seems almost exclusively populated by minor characters. Like there's one major character, and everybody else is sort of in his orbit.
It's kind of the way he likes it, though.
Exactly. No, I think it's quite by design.
One of the other things that occurred to me in listening to the full series that I had never really known before is that there were really actually, and maybe they were minor players, but there were a lot more women in the orbit of Watergate than we'd been led to believe. And maybe that's because that's the way history has often been told through the years. But, you know, it's not something that comes out in most stories of Watergate.
Yeah, it was something that we were happy to see happen when we noticed it in our writing and reporting. It wasn't something we like deliberately set out to do, but I do think it's sort of a natural result of trying to find unexplored angles and trying to find. I get self-conscious calling them characters because they're real people, but in our search for sort of underappreciated or under-remembered characters, it's not that surprising that more of them turn out to be women. But you know, it was a happy sort of byproduct of our broader mission to try to find fresh ways into this rather familiar story.
Now, you had always worked in print before this project,
yep.
Aside from this music video you were telling me about as we sat here. So sound would not necessarily have mattered, but in addition to the audio interviews you did for the series, talk about your impressions of some of the archival sound that you used to illustrate it.
Well, I've been thinking about this a little bit lately because I'm currently working on what will be season two of Slow Burn about the Clinton years, and I'm realizing as I'm kind of working with the archival footage that I can't expect it to be as transporting as the stuff that we used in this show, because it just sounds a lot more similar to what we are used to hearing. Like, TV from the 90s doesn't sound that different from TV in 2018. The intro music for like the evening news is a little more brassy and a little more dramatic maybe than it is now, but to the point where you can kind of date it. But the way that people talk, the way they sound, the way the recording sounds, you can't date it as precisely as when you hear John Chancellor speaking, as an NBC anchor, both in terms of how the recording sounds and in terms of his, accent's the wrong word, but just his dialect. And you could think of it in retrospect as like a crutch. I mean, it was so instantly transporting to hear some of this tape. Or like one of my favorite recordings that we used was, lost my train of thought. I'll come back to it. I'll remember.
Well, yeah.
Sorry.
Go back to John Chancellor for a second, because I know some people have kind of described him as the co-narrator in this series.
That's right.
What did having
yes.
John Chancellor's voice throughout the series mean for it?
Well, there's a reason that we used a lot of John Chancellor, which is not a sexy reason, and that reason is that we got a great licensing deal with NBC that allowed us to use him, and other networks were less generous, and so we used less of them. But at the same time, it was also again a happy kind of byproduct in that he did feel like a presence throughout, and it was cool to hear him sound a little bit different based on what was happening. So in most of the recordings that you hear in the season, rather in the show, he sounds calm. Like he's just the kind of inveterate newsman who is steady and dispassionate. And then the tape of him reacting to the Saturday Night Massacre, he is shaken, and you can tell he's shaken. And it just sort of spoke to how wild that moment was. And I think if you heard just that out of context, you might not necessarily appreciate it. So I was happy to have him as my co-pilot.
Well, and you bring up the idea that dialect has kind of changed. And it hasn't been chronologically all that many years, but you listen to the politicians of the era talk, and their speaking style is completely different than what we are used to hearing from politicians today.
Yeah, I mean, especially Nixon, who, as we were discussing before the show, had such a distinctive way of speaking, and just a total wonder that he became president, given how strange he was and how socially clumsy and just awkward he was. You'd think to be the most powerful politician in the country, you have to have a little finesse.
Right. I was saying my 13-year-old daughter heard Nixon for the first time and said, that is what Richard Nixon sounded like.
Yeah, it's wild. We just did my producer and I, Andrew Parsons, we just finished a sort of special episode of a different project that I won't go into details of. But basically, it's about Richard Nixon as a young man playing football at college and being really, really bad at it. And the sort of animating question of this thing that we made that will be in the Slow Burn feed, hopefully, in the next few weeks, was what if Nixon had been good at football? would we have perhaps been spared all of this carnage that we saw as a result of his physical and social awkwardness?
Have you remembered that favorite piece of tape yet?
Yeah, it was Ed Muskie possibly crying, possibly just wiping a snowflake away from his eye after his wife was maligned in the press. But there's something about how scratchy it is. He's like standing in front of the newspaper's offices when the newspaper that printed the thing that he was angry about, and I think it's partly his voice, it's partly just the scratch of the tape, and maybe partly the music that we put under it. But it really just feels like from a different planet or something.
As do the actual Oval Office recordings, the Smoking Gun tape, and all of these really historically significant audio artifacts that were recorded from inside the White House Oval Office, they are almost unintelligible.
That's one of the things I was disappointed in. When we started, I thought to myself, we're going to have all this amazing audio to work with, like Nixon talking to his, to his aides. We're going to be able to use all this stuff. And I wrote some of it into some early scripts before I had really listened to it. It's completely unusable because someone told me, and I haven't been able to confirm this, that Nixon used really cheap tape. The tape that they used in these machines was really poor quality because they didn't want to spend the money. I don't know if that's true, so I probably shouldn't say it, but I like that theory. You can't understand a word they're saying other than occasional swear words. There's a good tape.
You mean expletives deleted?
Well, yeah, expletives deleted. We found a good tape while we were doing the football thing of Nixon watching football with his daughter Julie and screaming curse words at the TV. Those you can make out, more or less. One of my favorite sort of details that I learned in my reading was that when Nixon was negotiating with the special prosecutor about whether he was going to hand over these tapes, he said, look, I'll make you a deal. He did this to his lawyers. It wasn't literally him saying this, but he said, I'll make you guys a deal. I'll choose a neutral third party who can listen to them, and I will prepare some transcripts that I will lightly edit, that I will take out national security stuff, I'll take out irrelevant stuff, and this neutral third party can just listen to the tapes, read the transcripts, and confirm for you guys that the transcripts are authentic and in good faith. And he said, actually, we actually have a neutral third party in mind, a Senator Stennis, who was an ancient man who was famously hard of hearing. And
had just gotten out of the hospital,
had just gotten out of the hospital because he'd been, attacked by a mugger and had, mostly missed all of Watergate because he was in the hospital for months. And this guy was going to listen to these tapes that I can't hear with my mostly perfect hearing. The notion that he was going to be able to confirm anything is just cartoonish.
How foreign for you was writing for the ear and also writing in such a way that, I won't use the term cliffhanger, but I guess I just did, but writing in such a way that you conclude in a way that makes people want to listen to it again the next week?
Yeah, it was new. I had to learn to write with much shorter sentences, never use subordinate clauses. These are I guess this is Radio 101, but I had never taken Radio 101. NPR actually has amazing guides to writing for radio, just sitting online, that you can download and read, and those were extremely helpful. Also, the This American Life put out a comic book for how to write for radio, which was really cool. The biggest thing that I had to learn was that you need to be guided by the audio that you have, right? So, whereas when you're in print, I might have my sense of what is the most important argument to make or the most important story to tell, and I will make that argument or tell that story based on that reason. With this, if we had, a story we wanted to tell, but we didn't have any tape with which to illustrate it or with which to break up my, yammering, it wasn't going to work. And so, by the halfway mark or so, I started really getting better at listening to what we had, whether it was, the archival tape that my producer sent to me, in the form of what he calls cut sheets, or whether it was interviews that we had done specifically for the show. And I would listen to that stuff specifically with an ear for, Elizabeth Holtzman sounds amazing saying, telling this little story. The little story that maybe isn't the most important story, but we're going to include it because we have this audio. And that was, I think kind of required me to reverse my thought process a little bit from where it was when I was writing for print.
You had to decide whether having the sound was I guess the trying to think of how to ask this question, but there were times where you used the sound because the sound was so strong, and in that case, you yourself could be telling the most important part of the story with an ear towards making sure what Elizabeth Holtzman or whoever said in such a compelling way.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And I think learning when to get out of the way was an important skill for me to learn, sort of figuring out what is worthwhile to quote someone on, you know, and it turns out that like facts aren't the thing that you want your interview material to be providing to the audience. You should be giving sort of basic facts, and then you want the interview subjects to be giving texture and emotion. That's the most important thing. So yeah, those are all things I kind of had to learn, mostly from my producer, who is way more experienced in audio than I was or am.
It's a lot of emotion that's still out there, considering this stuff happened 45 years ago.
Yeah, man, people remember it like yesterday. So it was really, I didn't realize how lucky I was until I talked to someone. I didn't realize how lucky I was to be getting such vivid memories from people until I talked to someone who really didn't remember a thing. And it was really obvious that she didn't remember anything. And it wasn't her fault. Like, I probably won't remember anything about right now in 45 years. It kind of dawned on me, oh, this is like what I should have been expecting all along. And I've just been extraordinarily fortunate to find people who, you know, for one reason or another, have been able to keep this stuff intact in their heads.
We're just about ready to take questions from the audience here, but I want to ask you this. There are clearly a lot of parallels people can draw between Watergate and the current state of presidential politics, but you never really belabor that in the course of this series. I mean, you bring it up at the beginning and at the end of the series explicitly, but were you trying consciously to give Watergate its own breathing room?
I would say we were obviously aware of the parallels that listeners were also aware of, but we didn't deliberately run towards them. We didn't deliberately seek them out, and I wasn't necessarily expecting them. Like, we obviously started doing this because of the current political situation and because we felt like there was a broad parallel in the sense that here was a period of time in American history when the country's political situation or the functioning of the government felt very precarious, and when a period of time when people were waking up in the morning and not knowing what was going to happen next, and they were reading about things in the newspaper that had never happened before. And what did that feel like? And did it feel similar to the way we feel now? And, you know, that's obviously a premise in which the idea of parallels is sort of embedded. But we did not expect the level of sort of just like the specificity of the parallels that we ended up finding. I mean, my favorite, and this is actually an example of one where I did kind of write towards it a little bit because I did, it was just sort of too good to leave on the cutting room floor. But so at a certain point, Nixon was being pressured to release more tapes. He'd released some tapes to the special prosecutor. He had to release more, or he was being asked to release more. And he, once again, tried to compromise by publishing. They did, in fact, publish official government, printed government printing office editions of this, thousands of pages of transcripts of Oval Office tapes that, again, had been edited. And he said they were edited. He said, you know, we've taken out national security stuff, we've taken out irrelevant stuff, but, you know, the important things are here, and there's plenty of embarrassing stuff in here. What he didn't think about was that by that point, some of the conversations that were reflected in those transcripts had been subpoenaed and had been actually handed over to the impeachment inquiry. And so there were members of the House who had listened to the tapes that were represented in these transcripts. And so they saw these transcripts and they went back to their notes on the tapes they'd listened to. And they were like, wait, there are major things missing here. There are entire passages where Nixon all but says, I did a crime, that aren't here. And so they leaked it. They leaked those discrepancies to the press. And Pat Buchanan, then working as a sort of speechwriter slash spokesman slash advisor to Nixon, went out to the press and said, you guys should be, you journalists should be looking at the real story, which is these leaks. You know, how can you, you know, you got to figure out who these leakers are. And so, gosh, you know, that is just, you know, it could have happened yesterday, or you could have read the same quote yesterday from Pat Buchanan, in fact. So in that case, I did sort of deliberately include, it's not an important moment in the story of Watergate, but it was kind of delightful. So,
okay, before we get to the questions from the audience, and this is maybe spoiler alert, last episode, you come out of doing this series with a palpable sense of hope. And I was hoping that you might elaborate a little bit on why reporting for as long as you did on Watergate leaves you with a sense of hope today.
Well, I don't know how hopeful I am. I think insofar as it did make me hopeful to learn the details of this story, it was that it's because there were just so many people who stood up and kind of acted and took initiative in whatever ways they could, whether they were members of, you know, the Senate Watergate Committee, or whether they were just little 25-year-old lawyers who worked for the senators in the Senate Watergate Committee. There were a lot of people who did their jobs, and they, as a result, the institutions that they were part of kind of played their proper function, played their proper role. You don't play a function.
Serve their proper function.
Thank you. There you go. And so that makes me hopeful. I feel like people are motivated to you know, insofar as there's wrongdoing to be uncovered, people are motivated to uncover it right now. And on the other hand, it did also feel to me, though, as though the result, the outcome of this story, the ending of Watergate, was in no way inevitable. Like it was the result of, again, many different people doing, you know, taking initiative. And if they hadn't, and if things hadn't broken a certain way, then it might have ended a very different way. In some cases, it wasn't about anyone taking initiative. It was about people making stupid decisions, like Nixon deciding to tape himself committing crimes. You know, a misfire that I think determined the course of the story as much as anything else. You know, the fact that there was a John Dean, that the guy, you know, a White House counsel who was willing to testify in the way he did, and there could have not been one, you know, and who knows how it would have turned out if there hadn't been.
So I think this is a great time to start taking some questions. Chris has the microphone, and I don't know how much cord.
Yeah, I was going to walk around knowing that a lot of you are stuck in here, but I can't walk very far with this. So if you do have any questions, feel free to sort of line up down this aisle here, and we can take them that way.
I can't tell if these are questions or people leaving.
That didn't even occur to me.
First, thank you so much for being here for all of us in Milwaukee.
Thank you.
I'm a U.S. history teacher at a local high school, and I teach this every year. And just when you think you know the facts, I saw an interview with Pat Buchanan recently, and not from in the 70s, but recently. And this is probably his spin, of course, that he's still doing, but it was striking to me how much he thought the Saturday Night Massacre was the media who hated Nixon over-exaggerating that story, when really it's just a president letting a couple people go. Now, obviously, that's his hyperbole, but what is your take on that? I never actually heard the Saturday Night Massacre, because conventional wisdom is, you know, how constitutional crisis it was. So
yeah.
What is your take on that?
And for people who don't know what the Saturday Night Massacre is, briefly.
Sure. So after the so-called Stennis Compromise that I was referring to earlier, where they wanted the deaf guy to listen to the tapes, was rejected by the Special Prosecutor's Office, Nixon sort of used that as a pretext to fire him and said, you know, this guy's not willing to meet me halfway. We can't work with this guy. And so he ordered his attorney general to fire him. The attorney general refused. The deputy attorney general refused. And then the task of firing the special prosecutor fell to the Solicitor General, Robert Bork. And so the firing of the attorney general and the firing of the deputy attorney general and the firing of the special prosecutor became known very quickly, to my surprise. I assumed that Saturday Night Massacre was like a name they came up with later, but it was almost immediate. The media started calling it that. I don't think Pappy Cannon is right. I think people really were freaked out when it happened. I guess they were freaked out because they were watching the news, and on the news they were explaining why it was a scary series of events. So I guess in that sense it was because of the media. But no, I think it really chilled people to feel like they were in that the government was. That the president was consolidating power in this way, and that he seemed resolved to, destroy the Department of Justice in the name of in service of protecting himself, and I think people were sincerely scared, and I think the public outcry that followed it speaks to that. I think people were I'm trying to remember the numbers, but I can't. But basically, the Western Union in Washington D.C. was so overwhelmed. With telegrams, both to the White House and to the Special Prosecutor's Office, letters of condemnation to the White House, letters of support to the Special Prosecutor's Office, they had to bring in like workers from outside Washington to handle this mass of letters coming in. And so that's more like anecdote than data, but the public opinion polls show that there's a very obvious swing from right before it happened to right after. And so, I suppose it's a media creation in the sense that that's how people found out about it. But I think it was the facts of what occurred that created that shift or that sea change.
It is kind of amazing to think of people being so fired up about something that they go down to a telegraph office.
I know.
Hi, thank you for being here, like he said. So I'm studying to be a high school history teacher, and a lot of what I notice in history is that there's action and reaction. So I guess this is a question for both of you guys, you as a journalist and you studying politics and working in Capitol Hill. Oh, sorry about that. Oh, God. Capitol Hill. So with the Watergate scandal, with the Clinton scandal, with the 2016 presidential election, and all the scandals that have followed up until then, do you find that, like, what would your prediction be for the state of our democracy in the next 10 years? Like, I suppose I should get more specific on that. Do you find it that it could become more of a regulated democracy where the government takes more control, so things like that doesn't happen, or more of a true democracy where the people learn from their mistakes and vote differently in opposition to try and fix their mistakes?
Mitch?
Thank you. and it has been years since I worked on Capitol Hill, but the thing that still sticks with me about that time is how the corridors of the House office buildings and the Senate office buildings are really just filled with regular people, most of whom, at least in my experience, were really trying to do the right thing. And that may well be a different scenario in Washington today. I know, the halls of power are separated from the people outside a great deal more just because of everything that's happened since, 2001, certainly. But what the implications for democracy are, I don't know.
I feel like the most worrying trend, and I'm not like probably the millionth person to say this, but the fact that people get their news in pretty siloed ways, where if you believe certain things, you can read the news that confirms those beliefs, and if you believe other things, you can read different news that confirms those beliefs. I feel like the more insulated people become from facts that challenge their worldviews, the less opportunity there is for them to change their minds or for them to, change how they think about, their leaders, for example. I just don't know how it will happen if everyone can just continue kind of, if everyone's priors are sort of reaffirmed every time they turn on the TV or read the internet. I don't know, it doesn't matter what happens then, right? Because it'll be described in the way that is consistent with the thing that they already believe and want to keep believing. Sorry.
Hi. Once again, thanks for coming out this evening. I wanted to know June 17th, 1972, the five men that were caught attempting to bug the Watergate, the Democratic National Committee office. I'm curious to know if there were other charges that these individuals committed, or were there any other crimes committed by the Nixon team? And if so, what were the sanctions involved with that?
So a lot of people went to prison, and a lot of people got convicted for crimes that weren't just about the that involved things way beyond the burglary. I mean, the litany of like what is now known as dirty tricks that the Nixon campaign carried out is truly mind-boggling. It's really just out of not science fiction, but I guess out of spy novels. They're like cartoon spy novels, because there's some of the stuff they did was so stupid. Cartoonish. I'm using that word again, but like they would order pizzas, you know, to the rally for their political opponents so that they would get confused by the pizzas. I don't know. They would steal keys out of the motorcade while the drivers were out smoking, so that when the drivers came back in, they couldn't move the cars. Just really small stuff like that. They had spies, you know, that were pretending to be journalists, that who were, you know, going on the press plane as if they were working for a newspaper, and in fact they were reporting back to Nixon.
There was a driver that was like a double agent.
Yeah, there was a driver who was supposed to be he was working for the McGovern campaign, and he was supposed to be ferrying documents, I think from the I forget, from one place to another. And instead of going from point A to point B, he was stopping at a hotel room where he had a copier set up, where he would copy all the stuff and then hand it over to the Nixon team. The biggest, I think the most serious crime that was committed in sort of as part of the Dirty Tricks campaign had to do with the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg was an obsession for Nixon. Daniel Ellsberg, the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, Nixon was obsessed with him and wanted to punish him in any way possible. And again, people don't really know what Nixon directly ordered, what he merely sort of tacitly encouraged or allowed. But regardless, Nixon's guys broke into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in search of any kind of documentation that would prove that he was crazy or that he was untrustworthy, and they didn't find anything. And I believe they sprinkled like pills everywhere. They tried to like rustle up the office to make it look like a drug addict had ransacked it. I mean, just really two-bit stuff. And a guy got arrested, actually. A guy got arrested for that break-in and served some time. I'm not sure how long. Totally innocent guy. He confessed to breaking into the Daniel Ellsberg psychiatrist's office as part of confessing to a bunch of other robberies that he actually had committed. But then later it turned out that he was in jail the night of the robbery and couldn't have done it. I bring this up only because there's an amazing fact that I couldn't include in the show, which is that he went on to become the live-in boyfriend of Mae Russell, the conspiracy theorist in episode 6.
Well, and the point you bring up in the series is that you can't have a conspiracy without conspiracy.
Watergate proved that conspiracies are real. And yeah, exactly. Like all these dirty tricks, like they require people to sit in a room and like come up with them. And it's hard to imagine. And I think that's part of why it took a long time for people to assimilate Watergate and take it seriously, because it just seems so unlikely and so preposterous that the president of the United States, the guy who was, you know, opening China and traveling to, you know, making nuclear peace deals, you know, with the Soviet Union, that he was overseeing these grubby two-bit break-ins. It just didn't seem plausible. But there you go.
I have a quick question for you regarding your research process. What did that look like, and what was your most surprising lead as you researched this series?
What do you mean by lead?
I work as a researcher, so the piece, the thing that you wouldn't expect would lead you to the next big breakthrough.
Hmm. Gosh, I don't know if I have a good one like that. Well, you know, it was a thrill to request the, like, staff list for the House Banking Committee from the House historian and have him send me this PDF, you know, old-looking PDF, and then go through the list of names on there, figure out who's still alive, and then call them and reach Curtis Prinz, who says, no one's ever called me before. Like, that was, you know, that's as good as it gets, I would say. You know, as far as the broader process, like, I began by trying to kind of gulp down as quickly as possible the most sort of wide-ranging works on Watergate. So that meant like watching the documentaries, reading the like sort of omnibus histories. And then from there, kind of as we became more confident about which parts of the story we were going to focus on, which characters we were going to you know, use as the as our anchors for certain episodes, I would go and then maybe read a memoir by someone, you know, that didn't contain a ton of information, but contained information on the thing that I needed.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Hello. Thank you for coming here. And I actually don't go to UW-Milwaukee. I'm up at Lawrence University in Appleton, and this was a great excuse to come home for a weekend. I was wondering, you earlier were talking about how this specific story of the Watergate break-in and the investigation and revelations that came after it were a great subject for an audio medium. And then, of course, you touched on how right now in crafting something about the Clinton years, it's not as much of a perfect fit. What do you think will be the, as a journalist, what do you think will be the best or the most fitting medium for today's news and controversy as we go forward and say in 30 years someone wants to go back and look at this decade and era of politics, and how, where do you think journalism will go to accommodate the news today?
So I asked a similar question of Bob Woodward at that live event I was describing earlier, and I think the version of it I asked was like, where do you think the All the President's Men of about this will come from? Like, will it be a book? Will it be a movie? And he said that I have a disease. He said I have a disease shared by many young journalists that, because we want to know the future before we've understood the present. He really laid into me for that one, which I will not do to you.
I feel like Fever Dream might be a good medium.
I mean, honestly, I think I this is a boring answer, but I'm pretty sure someone will write a great book about it that will be the definitive, you know, that will contain the definitive story. It's hard to imagine someone being able to absorb everything that we're living through just by like Googling for it, you know? Like, imagine trying to, I mean, at this point, Google, like, if you search for someone who has said, who has been in the news in the last 5 minutes, if you Google their name, you'll only get results from the last 5 minutes, 20 pages deep. But like, if you were to try to reconstruct a day of this period of time just by searching for it online, I think it would be very hard because you wouldn't know what's important and you wouldn't know what was a red herring. You need someone to sit there and do it for you and put it in a book, I think.
I have a strange sort of slow burn idea where you install an app that will drop news alerts like as it happened over the time,
yeah.
But in the future as a journalism project.
Yeah, that's cool. People have done that for like the Civil War, I think. They've like created you know, Twitter accounts that tweet out as if, you know, the Civil War is happening right now. Slate did a really cool project at the end of this past year where we made this like animation of all the New York Times news alerts that had been sent. And it's very overwhelming. And in fact, maybe, you know, you could do worse, I think, but if you wanted to understand this, you know, the last year than to watch that animation. So I think actually your idea might be better than my suggestion of writing a book. I think watching that animation, which I recommend everyone do, and not just because I work there, you really get like your heart starts beating faster at certain points when you start remembering, oh God, and then Comey's going to get fired. And there's like six alerts that day. I like that idea very much.
Hi. I was alive during Watergate, but I was in junior high, and I didn't really understand it till I read all the President's Men in the 80s. And at the time when I read that, the Iran-Contra scandal was going on, and I remember thinking, it's funny that you talked about the dirty tricks. I thought, this is just like small potatoes compared to what was happening with Reagan and his people that really involved people, you know, going to war.
Yeah.
And so I wondered why, and if you have any insight, why this kind of stuff brought down the president and so many people. And Reagan kind of still, for some people, has a halo over his head.
Boy, so I don't know. I know nothing about Iran-Contra. And we were thinking about doing it as the second season. We still might maybe do a future season on it. And when we do, I will be able to answer your question. But honestly, it's a total blind spot for me. And it seems totally fascinating. And it does seem way more serious, than breaking into the DNC. From what I know of it. So
right.
I don't know.
When you said we're going to the Clintons, I was like, well, you skipped a lot of time. Yeah.
But you know, actually, one of the interesting points, you talk about the halo that exists for many people still around Ronald Reagan. And I think the interesting thing is that in the time since Watergate, Richard Nixon's image was really rehabilitated. And then looking back at this period takes some of the luster off of that rehabilitation.
Yeah, so I actually looked into this a little bit when I was preparing for that live show, because that was literally the theme was like, how do different people try to intervene on, you know, our conventional wisdom? How did Richard Nixon try to intervene on our conventional wisdom? And the answer is he tried to do it very aggressively. He wrote all these books. He went on multiple like sort of charm tours.
David Frost.
David Frost was an attempt, yeah. That David Frost interview was when he blamed Martha Mitchell for Watergate by saying that if only her husband had been less distracted by her antics, maybe none of this would have happened. I think it was working for a little bit. Like there was a Newsweek cover where it had just had Richard Nixon and the words, he's back, in like 1986, I think. But I don't think it really stuck. I think for the most part, there's like a shocking amount of consensus that what he did was bad and that ousting him from the presidency was good. I think if you look at the public opinion polls, I think they, like his approval ratings peak at like 60-ish% in like 87, which is at the height of his charm offensive. And then as soon as he dies, they just plummet again. And I think they're like, I don't want to say the number because I'm going to be wrong, but I think it's in the 30s. And it's sort of stayed there ever since.
So you had talked about there were being like more women involved than initially thought. Do you think that at the time there wasn't as many women saying something, or there wasn't as much coverage because the ERA was going on at the same time? Or do you think that now women are speaking out more than they did then?
Do you mean like women who were around then who are speaking about their roles now?
Yeah.
I just think people weren't necessarily asking them, right? Like, I don't think most people knew that Leslie Stahl was, at the first arraignment. I don't think there's a Leslie Stahl character in All the President's Men. It was fun to like put that back in on the record, sort of. I mean, she doesn't need my help, obviously. She's Leslie Stahl, but. It's telling that none of her stories made it to air. She told me about how she would be sitting in these court hearings, and then she would run to the phone in the courthouse and tell her editor what had just happened, and she didn't find out until later, I guess, that pretty much nothing she did made it to air. Someone said that they liked that Bob Woodward on Slow Burn primarily appears as Leslie Stahl's boyfriend, which he was during this period. And Carl Bernstein, apparently, or according to Leslie Stahl, Carl Bernstein accused her once, or maybe accused Woodward more accurately, of giving away stories to her, which she, of course, denies. But then when I asked Carl Bernstein about it, he also denied ever accusing her. So who knows?
So you talked earlier about how you're limited to the archive, especially audio archive, what you're going to research, which I totally understand. My question is, if you could have
if you could come upon a treasure trove of an archive of any historical event and do a deep dive, what would you do? Choose wisely.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, to choose wisely would mean like to go back to before there were things that could record sound. I suppose like the formation of the Soviet Union would be a fascinating thing to excavate if you could hear, if you could be in those rooms and hear those speeches, and you know, I think that would be a good one.
What are the questions that you still have out there about Watergate, about which you...
Why they ordered a break-in? Why do they do it? No one knows. Truly, no one knows. There's no consensus on this. Some people say it's because just that they were scared of losing, and so they just wanted any advantage they could get, which is, that's probably true. It's probably that's the boring answer, and it's probably correct. The really exciting answer, I sort of get into this a little bit in the conspiracy theory episode. It is a conspiracy theory, but it's a conspiracy theory that was believed and is believed by people like who worked on the Senate Watergate investigation, real people who had real access to the facts that we don't know and classified information. They believe that it was all about Howard Hughes. It all goes back to Howard Hughes. If you'll indulge me, the reason that
he... So it's episode 7, I think, right?
6, yeah. 6, okay. Yeah. So basically, the short version is Howard Hughes had lent a bunch of money to Nixon's best friend, B.B. Rebozo. And Nixon was worried that this loan, which was really, in this telling, was really a bribe, would be found out. And he had reason to believe that the head of the DNC, Lawrence O'Brien, who also had ties to Howard Hughes, knew about it. And he was terrified that the DNC would expose this loan slash bribe from Howard Hughes, and he wanted to get a jump on it. And so he had Lawrence O'Brien's phone tapped in case it yielded any intel on what they knew about the Howard Hughes loan and what they were planning to do with it. I love that theory that it was all about Howard Hughes, but I don't know if it's true.
The ultimate thing is that like had the break-in never been found, or had the people never been arrested, none of the rest of this stuff happens.
Yeah, or you know, I mean, they were pretty sloppy about everything else they did too, right? So it could have been a different thing if it wasn't this one. But who knows? I was struck at the end of this process by like how many things had to break a certain way for it to end the way it did, which is why like. That is reason for hope. Like, things could break right, but they could also not break right.
Do you feel like this is part of the historical, not the historical record, but this series gets added to This is Watergate?
I don't know. I hope so. Certainly it's going to be, it certainly contains everything I know about Watergate. I don't know if that'll be true for other people.
Do we have one more question?
Right now is that the Republican Party with the Trump is that it's not as important the crime that Trump has committed as long as they get their agenda through. What was it like in the Nixon years when the Republican Party finally went and pretty much didn't they not ask Nixon to resign? And was it because of the crime? And, you know.
Yeah, so there's like I think there's a popular conception that, you know, the in the fallout from Watergate, politicians in Washington put truth over party, and were willing to, you know, break with Nixon because of what he had done. And I think there are certain ways in which that's true. There's other ways in which it's not true at all, because when you look at, you know, sort of the individual, this sort of discrete stages that led to the end game, just let's say with the Senate Watergate Committee, right? This is a good example of this. So Howard Baker there were 7 senators on the Senate Watergate Committee, and there were 3 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Howard Baker was the ranking Republican. He is famous for this question that is an iconic Watergate question. What did the president know, and when did he know it? And we all think this is like, this was senators really giving it to these witnesses and, you know, really drilling down to the heart of the matter and pinning Nixon to the wall. But in fact, this question was asked for completely the opposite reasons. He wanted to prove that actually Nixon didn't know about anything in advance and therefore shouldn't be held responsible for it. You know, Howard Baker was an honorable Republican who was as mainstream as it gets and was seen as presidential timber by people, which a phrase that I read somewhere that I love. Basically, he was seen as a prospect for the presidency. He outwardly sort of played a person who was invested in bipartisanship. He, you know, voted with the Democrats on various measures like when to subpoena for tapes or when to do this or that. But in the lead up to those votes, he would argue for the course of action that was beneficial to the president until the bitter end, at which point he would switch in the interest of presenting a face of bipartisanship. And the whole way through, he was talking to the White House, and his staff was talking to the White House. The White House was giving the Republicans on the committee notes on what to ask people. And so, you know, they were protecting Nixon as much as they could while sort of presenting a less partisan face. It's true that at the very end, yeah, they abandoned him. But it was only after there was a tape released against Nixon's will by virtue of the Supreme Court ruling, in which Nixon could be heard saying, please use the CIA to stop the FBI from investigating me, that Republicans had to finally give up on him and they had to concede that this party was over. But it was really up to that. Really up to the bitter end. There were many, many Republican loyalists, not just in the electorate, but you know, in positions of power.
Unless there are any last questions, well, I just have to say you and your colleagues have done an amazing thing with this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here.